DeVico. You want to see what he looks like? A character. Dare I say, an Italian. He's interested in being alive. These are alive ideas. Nothing pre-digested. These are live ideas. So he calls, rebaptizes the Leibnizian point as Zenonian. We are acquainted with his typically humanistic propensity to retrodate and disguise modern concepts and terms under classical garb and features. But actually, as I just explained, it isn't just one of these ploys to retrodate something. Vico actually meant that he understood that this was law. This was an eternal cyclical image of vast proportions and dimensions, which in its revolution always comes around to this point sooner or later, and always moves on beyond there. The important point is to establish whether he, as a convinced and self-taught conservative, did or did not grasp the speculative theme, which was thoroughly new and original in his time, and so pregnant with remote developments. And the fact is, he not only grasped it, he used it continuously. Now, I'm probably going to run out of time, but I want to take you into the new science as much as I can. There's a translation of the autobiography from Cornell University paperbacks and a translation of the new science. The introduction here is terrible. Don't read the introduction. It's just, they center on to the use of certain terms in Vicoian senses, and you can go on and on and on. With someone like Vico, he's just vain enough and mad enough to tell you exactly what he's doing all the time. So it's better to listen to Vico on Vico than anyone else. In fact, he has right near the beginning the idea of the work. And he says, this new science studies the common nature of nations in the light of divine providence. Very big on providence. Providence is working all the time, but not by coming in and making miraculous changes and adjustments. But providence is constantly working because it's like the basic pattern, core, of the way in which this cycle actually moves. In the light of divine providence, the common nature of nations discovers by this new science the origins of institutions, religious and secular, among the Gentile nations, and thereby establishes a system of the natural law of the gentes, which proceeds with the greatest equality and constancy through the three ages, which the Egyptians handed down to us as the three periods through which the world had passed up to their time. In other words, we not only have the European cycle that we know about, we have the Roman cycle, which we know about, and we have the Egyptian cycle, which we know about. So we have lots of proof, he says, all over the place. We have correlations all over the place. There is an exception, and the exception is the history of the Jewish people. And they are an exception, Vico says. They are not in the pattern of history because their organization is according to God's mind and not man's mind. He believed this. The three ages are these. The first, the age of gods, in which the Gentiles believed they lived under divine governments and everything was commanded them by auspices and oracles, which are the oldest institutions in profane history. So you had oracles, and then second, you had the heroic age of Homer, and then you had the third age of man with laws. So you went from oracles to epic heroic poems, the poetical insight, to law. And finally, when law matured itself to understand in scientific terms the wholeness of the pattern, the law became clear that its overall universal structure was accordance with the structural capacities of man's mind. And that's as far as man can go. Because he can't go to God's mind. He can only go to his mind. And so there's a ceiling, there's a curtailing, there's a governor on history. Man can only advance to where he comprehends everything in terms of his mind, and then he decays, just like a plant in its time, and falls back into barbarism and chaos. And that all this is, as Biko says, seemingly implanted, explicitly implicit in the nature of man's mind. The second, the age of heroes, the third, the age of men. So he goes on then, and he will give us all kinds of background, but to save time, I'll just pass over all this. And in book two of the New Science, he comes to poetic wisdom. And in poetic wisdom, he now moves away from the time when oracles and belief in gods was paramount. We now come to the prolegomena in the introduction, where he says, "We have said above in the axioms that all the histories of the Gentile nations have had fabulous beginnings, that among the Greeks, who have given us all we know of Gentile antiquity, the first sages were the theological poets, and that the nature of everything born or made betrays the crudeness of its origin. It is thus, and not otherwise, that we must conceive the origins of poetic wisdom. And as for the great and sovereign esteem in which it has been handed down to us, this has its origin in the two conceits, that of nations and that of scholars, and it springs even more from the latter, scholars, than from the former. For just as Manetho, the Egyptian high priest, translated all the fabulous history of Egypt into a sublime natural theology, so the Greek philosophers translated theirs into philosophy. Philosophy. So that the poetic consciousness engenders not only poetry, but philosophy. And as philosophy interiorizes itself and humanizes itself, it becomes more and more science. And as science becomes more powerful in its certainty, in its capacity to designate specific causal linkages, definitely being able then to get to a point where its inductive capacity rushes on from its circumstance and begins to look ahead, man reaches a flash point where he is able to characterize it all. And from that point onward, man falls back, slips back, psychically, inevitably, like a glacier, back into barbarism. So that as he gives us all the way through book two, poetic metaphysics, a section on poetic logic, a section on poetic morals, poetic economy, Vico goes whole hog, poetic politics. He's developing the entire pattern, you see. Epitomes of poetic history. This whole divine and heroic history of the theological poets was only too unhappily described for us in the fable of Cadmus. For first he slays the great serpent, clears the earth of the great ancient forest. Then he sows the teeth, a fine metaphor for his plowing the first fields of the world with curved pieces of hard wood, which before the use of iron was discovered must have served as the teeth of the first plow, and teeth they are continued to be called. You see how his mythopoetic insight takes language and structure and refashions it into a powerful investigating tool which all but chews up whatever we would designate as nature, whatever we would designate as history, carves it up into a mental mash which is then fermented and bottled and categorized according to its conditional aspects as laid down by the science. Man is not just toying around with ores to find gold, he is fractionating his history to find the bitter truth, the awesome wholeness of his capacity. And Vico goes on, poetic physics, even that, a section on poetic cosmography, and then poetic astronomy, and then poetic chronology, which Vico brings us to this summation of the poetic realms. He will give us geography also, but he says here in poetic chronology, the theological poets gave beginnings to chronology in conformity with their astronomy. For that same Saturn, who was so called by the Latins from sati, sown fields, and who was called chronos, or time, by the Greeks, gives us to understand that the first nations, all composed of farmers, began to count their years by their harvests of grain, the sole or at least the chief thing for which the peasants labored all year. And since they were at first mute, they must have held as many ears or straws and made as many reaping motions as the number of years they meant to signify. Thus, in Virgil, as learned as ever man was in his heroic antiquity, and what Vico means to say here, not only that Virgil was the most learned man in the heroic age of Rome, but in any heroic age, that there always will be a heroic age at some time or other. There will always be someone more or less like Virgil. He will peer in sort of a tragic comedy mode at himself and realize there will always be someone like Vico, first understanding this enormous cycle that man's mind is party to. Then in book three, the discovery of the true Homer. And Vico is the first man ever to say there wasn't a Homer. He was from this heroic age that was somewhat unconscious, and therefore they said Homer was blind. How better way to understand that, of course he was blind, he was semi-unconscious. It was a capacity of man that wasn't fully understood. Vico is also the first, and we've had many in the 20th century, who would rewrite all of history to prove their points. Many of the writers in this study, the symposia on Vico, say Karl Marx was really a two-bit imitation compared to Vico. Vico is very, very much a powerful, first-rate mind, completely unschooled, completely unconnected with anybody else. So he has the discovery of the true Homer, the rational history of the dramatic and lyric poets, and then in book four, the course the nations run. There is a cycle. There is a development, because when we get to the phase of the nation-state, of the great empire, where the democracies will have to come into play and raise themselves up to an empire level, when they get to that point, that's when the decay begins to set in motion. Then a whole section on final proofs to confirm the course of nations. He's saying, I'm not speculating. I'm working with abstract principles which have a geometrical, verifiable validity and a application. The verum actually is applied to the datum, the facts. We have the material. They didn't know they were writing it for me, he says. I'm just bringing it here and bringing it together because I have the principle, because I have a developed mind which can understand the structure. I know how all this fits together. And he's saying, I am the first man who realizes this. Then book five, the final part of the new science, the recourse of human institutions which the nations take when they rise again. What's the recourse? That little bit of divine sentiment still lingers in man, the need for an order, the need for a little more permanency, the need to sanctify and extend his marriages, his burials, his sense of religion. And he says the whole cycle resuscitates itself again after long dark ages. Man begins to grow again. And this great organic plant of the cycle of history with millions and billions of human beings begins to grow towards its apex. Or at some time or another, another Vico will first discover what it all means. Vico died in 1744 in January. He is the prototype of the first great mastermind of the Enlightenment, soon to be followed in rapid succession all the way through the rest of the course by geniuses of equal stature and wildness. And next week we'll have the first example of such a person, the great mysterious Wonder Man, the Comte de Saint-Germain.